Hour 3 of the show, Amy, Mark Scores, Chris Ranji. This is KMOX, and it is time to go to the guest line this afternoon after a number of executive orders have been signed by new President Donald Trump over the last now what has been 8 days. How it affects the military and operations that are ongoing around the world, we thought we'd bring in our expert. It is retired U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, a CBS radio and television military analyst who is with us now on KMOX. How's it going, Colonel?
Going very well, thanks. Hope you guys are doing well.
Colonel McCausland, let's start with the executive order to freeze foreign aid that would regard humanitarian programs, counterterrorism efforts, and weapons financing. A lot to ask about this. The first one is, does this include any aid to Ukraine and Israel?
Well, apparently it may include aid to Israel. The one exception I have seen is aid to Israel. Military aid to Israel will continue. In fact, the Trump administration removed a restriction the Biden administration had imposed, at least for a time, and that is to not provide Israel 2,000-pound bombs. The argument from the Pentagon being these kind of weapons in a densely urban environment, as they were confronted there in Gaza, were going to produce far too many civilian casualties.
These are two different operations that are ongoing. But why do you think it is, just generally speaking, that Republicans seem to be pretty on board with assisting Israel and whatever effort they need, but not with Ukraine, which is also facing an adversary of ours?
Yeah, it is difficult to understand in many ways, but I think the easy answer is that's the preference for President Donald Trump. And Mr. Trump has very strong control over his party in many, many ways, and therefore very strong control of the United States Senate. We saw that in the recent confirmation of Pete Hegseth, which was the narrowest confirmation, I think, in U.S. History for a cabinet member, as well as in the House. So that's his preference. That translates into what we see on Capitol Hill. That being said, of course, Israel is a longstanding ally of the United States, has been an ally since the independence of the State of Israel back in 1949. Ukraine, a lot more recent, a lot of close relations, particularly between Mr. Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, and less, you know, closer affiliations, perhaps, between the United States and Ukraine, a relatively new country of some 30 years or so.
Yeah, I guess looking at it, would you say that there is an argument there from Donald Trump or from those Republicans that the geopolitical repercussions of Israel falling or being overcome by its enemies is different and inherently, or at least immediately, more destabilizing than Ukraine being taken over by Russia?
Well, some might try to make that particular argument. I think that would be a difficult argument just on the terms you describe, Amy, to make, because it seems to me, frankly, the collapse of Ukraine could, in fact, threaten NATO, the longest-standing alliance the United States has been involved with, the centerpiece, really, not only of our foreign and security policy in Europe, but really, in many ways, globally. Don't forget, it was a NATO mission in Afghanistan, the first time and only time NATO has invoked Article 5 in its history to come to the aid of a member was when the alliance invoked that particular article in response to the attack on the United States on September 11, 2001. The one other difference, frankly, or almost bluntly, or some might even say cynically, is the Israelis are winning, and at best, the Ukrainians right now are in a stalemate. Some think they're losing. So as a consequence, I think there's a reluctance on some people's part to provide additional military aid to Ukraine if, in fact, they think the prospects for Israeli immediate success on the battlefield are somewhat less. Israel has enjoyed, obviously, widespread success on the battlefield in the battle with Hamas and also with Hezbollah.
There has been a focus on the diversity, equity, inclusion, programs that exist within the military and really around the federal government over the last week plus. And I want to get to those in a moment. But in terms of military operations around the world, other than what's happening in Israel, how we're assisting there, how we have been assisting in Ukraine, are there some unintended consequences that could come elsewhere from these executive orders?
Well, there certainly could. I mean, of course, it's a matter of forces and deployments, how many troops you have and how many locations do you need to deploy? Some have said the United States doesn't have too few soldiers, it has too many requirements. And obviously one of our big requirements outside of supporting those two countries is requirements in the Indo-Pacific region, where we see more and more threats by China against our principal allies in that region, that being in most particularly the Philippines, and close relations that the United States has maintained with the island of Taiwan. So that's a concern. On any given day, there's always a concern about threats by North Korea against our allies in the northeastern Pacific region, most notably, of course, the Japanese and the South Koreans. And we've seen the North Koreans launch a cruise missile and a test just in the last couple of days. So that's a concern. Also, of course, if the President of the United States determines, as it seems he may, that he needs to deploy more and more U.S. forces to the border or involve more and more U.S. forces actually in the rounding up or the incarceration, at least temporarily, the detaining of illegal immigrants, if that gets to be a huge manpower requirement, then you've got to think about where do those forces come from and what places could you perhaps reduce forces to stay within the force structure that you have. And there has been already some suggestion the president may be seeking to reduce U.S. force presence in Europe, and that may be in response to these other requirements that we have globally.
Colonel, in your experience, what is the state of our forces as far as the numbers? Are we shorthanded? And as far as our weapon systems and what we have in reserve, are those filled to what they need to be?
Well, there's always two big concerns at the moment, I think. One is recruitment. We've seen over the last several years that many of our services, most notably the Army, which is the largest of all our military services, having difficulty recruiting. In the last year, for example, the Army was able to meet its recruiting requirement. Interestingly enough, it seemed that one of the reasons they were able to do that was a significant increase in female enlistment in the United States Army. So that's always a concern. And there is a question right now, as all these different programs happen to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion go away, will that affect recruiting in positive fashion or in negative fashion? In positive fashion, Mr. Hegseth and Mr. Trump, I think, believe that this is discouraging particularly young white males from joining the U.S. military and people leaving the military because they become discouraged by what they see as an awful lot of this stuff going on. My candid assessment, those are relatively few in number. On the other side of that coin, about 40% of the force or more are people of color or women. And as you move away from those particular projects, requirements, or talking about DEI and things like that, does that in fact discourage people of color and women from joining the military? And so how does that all sort of itself out in terms of recruitment is one question. The second, of course, is in terms of military equipment, hardware, and investment. And we got some serious challenges, most notably in our wartime stocks for ammunition, because of what we provided particularly to Ukraine as well as in Israel, and an acceleration in trying to build up our Navy, in particular, and expand the Navy. And that's running into a lot of problems in the defense industrial base. And that's why you saw in the testimony Hegseth provided in his confirmation hearings, he talked a good bit about accelerating production of military equipment, armaments, ammunition, et cetera, and breaking through some of the roadblocks that we have in the defense industrial base, producing things like ships, aircraft, et cetera.
Colonel Jeff McCausland is with us, and you know, you were talking about recruitment, and we don't have a draft, so we can't force people to be in the military, and we know right. that it has been difficult to recruit people. I know that you sort of touched on it already. You believe that what's happening now would ultimately hurt recruiting as opposed to helping it? Because I'm not really sure that people are not getting into the military because they think it's too woke. I feel like that's more narrative than reality. So I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Well, I happen to agree with you. I think it's much more narrative than reality. But there is no, I've seen absolutely no analytical evidence that suggests that's not true. But certainly that is a theme that Mr. Hegseth and President Trump have pushed, that people are not joining the military because of their concern for wokeness, or people are leaving the military because of their concern over wokeness. I don't think that's necessarily true. There also seems to be a possibility, the president has talked about this, for example, of changing the names of military bases, which were converted from the Confederate names in the South, like Fort Benning and Fort Bragg, to Fort Moore, named after a distinguished officer who got the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and he may change back. Is that going to encourage black young Americans to join the military? I kind of doubt it, frankly. If you limit where women can serve in the military, will that encourage more women to join? I certainly kind of doubt it. And furthermore, if you limit where women can serve in the military, you're also telling young women that they cannot expect to matriculate to the highest ranks of the U.S. military. Well, if that's the case, I think that will be a discouragement either for young women joining the military or, frankly, staying in the military for a career, which is in many ways what we'd like to have happen. But, you know, this is what we're going to see happen over the next couple of years. Will, in fact, we see a large spur in enlistment because of the removal of all these DEI requirements and training, et cetera, or, in fact, will we see that in the opposite direction? And then at the end of the day, frankly, what we the biggest impact on recruiting actually is unemployment in America. And if unemployment is low historically, and I've watched this for 50 years as far as recruits going, if unemployment is low, then it's difficult to get people to join the military because there are a lot of jobs available. And that certainly, at least for the time being, seems to be the case economically.
Yeah, you mentioned military as a career. How has that changed over time? You know, in your career in the military, you did it for, you know, your whole life until you retired. Do fewer people want to get into that and make that their lives until retirement? Or do they just kind of want to get in, serve the time they have to serve, get the benefits of serving, and then get out?
It's a bit of both, quite frankly. I'll be honest with you. When I joined the military or entered the military from West Point many, many years ago, I was uncertain whether I was going to make it a career. Over time, I found I enjoyed my service. I found a lot of opportunities. I ended up staying for 30 years. So I think there's very few people on the day they enlist or they're commissioned that say, okay, I'm convinced I'm going to stay in this for a whole career. It kind of sorts itself out over time. But the military has a real problem in that our retirement system is such that an officer or senior NCO can retire after 20 years of service. Well, that can mean they're 38 to 42 years of age. And quite frankly, they've been trained and prepared, and they're kind of at the prime of their effectiveness as a leader. And no corporation would invest in the leadership of the corporation only to see them take a full retirement shortly after the time they turn 40. So what we need to do is encourage more and more people to stay in the military. That's further exacerbated by the fact that due to changes in technology, the training requirements for a person to perform in the military are a lot higher than when I joined. To be a combat infantryman, when I joined the military in the 1960s, didn't take much time to train somebody to do that. Now, with sophisticated technologies, communications, use of drones, night vision goggles, et cetera, even the basic training for a soldier to be a combat infantryman is a lot more intense, and therefore we'd like him or her, quite honestly, to stay longer than simply a short-term enlistment.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, as always, we really appreciate you joining us and appreciate your expertise. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
That is U.S. Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, retired, and also CBS military analyst, joining us here on the show. We asked the question earlier, or we at least brought to you a poll that was done by Gallup about your or our, as Americans, our happiness, our current level of satisfaction in our personal lives versus our satisfaction with the United States and how things are going. Feel free to tell us how you feel personally and tell us why. On the Odyssey app, drop us a voice message. We'd like to hear from you. Or text or call 314-436-7900. Chris and Amy on KMOX.